Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of the UConn Pod. This is Aman Kidwai. I'm here with Tim Fontenot and Brenner Pizak. What's up, guys?
Hey, everybody.
How are you, Aman? Tim, glad to be here.
We're doing well. Tim and I were at a ice hockey game Tuesday night that went really, really well. Monumental win for UConn hockey program, 5-2 over number 8, Boston University. We got a hat trick from the freshman Tage Thompson, and I think a lot of people in the college hockey world were very impressed with what they saw from the Huskies. Definitely got a lot of national attention. Tim, thoughts from the big, big win for the Ice Bus at the XL Center last night?
Well, I'll start by saying that it's definitely a big win, but I wouldn't call it monumental, just because we're starting to now see Mike Cavanaugh bring in the players that he wanted to bring in order to make UConn what he described his goal as last night as a top 10 team. And they're definitely on their way to being one of the national contenders with the guys they're bringing in. I mean, we saw contributions from even seniors who were brought in to play Atlantic hockey. Like Joey Ferris had the goal last night. Patrick Kirtland and Sean Pauley had fantastic games. The juniors, I mean, there's few of them, but they did very well, and especially the sophomores and freshmen. The freshmen are absolutely amazing on this team. I mean, you look at Thompson, he was so opportunistic on the power play. They were 4 of 7 on the power play, and really because Thompson was on the doorstep on those rebound opportunities, had the two great in-front shots, and then stepped out to the left face-off circle on the third one and just sniped a shot on a great pass from Max Letinov. Letinov, again, had another big game. The former BU commit really just stealing the show at UConn. But the guys I want to talk about were sophomore Jesse Swartz and freshman Max Calter. They didn't score. They both had an assist on the Ferris goal, and they're not really going to be high-scoring guys. They're not going to really be the guys that stand out to most people. But the way they played last night, I thought, deserved a lot of recognition. They were fantastic. They were all over the ice, getting to every puck. They were winning battles in the neutral zone, putting their bodies on the line. There was one penalty kill for UConn where Jesse Swartz was about 5 feet away from a guy on the blue line, took a shot right in the arm, and you could tell right away that he was feeling it. He was hurt, and he clutched his arm to his chest, and he keeps one hand on the stick and keeps trying to poke the puck away. And then when another BU player lines up for a shot, he dives in front of it still, throws his stick at it, gets down on one knee, tries to block it, goes over to the bench, gets taped up, and he couldn't even get over the boards when he got back. They had to move players out of the way. He had to be helped over. They were trying to pull him over. And then trainer Ed Blair taped up his hand. Then he went back out for his next shift and kept going. And it was a couple shifts later that he set up the goal by poking the puck out of the neutral zone up to Calter. Calter, just a great job to feed it over to Ferris. They're guys that aren't going to show up on the three stars. Obviously, last night it was Tage Thompson and Rob Nichols, deservedly so. Nichols, another great game, but those are guys that really are going to make the difference for UConn. While the rest of the guys are putting in the goals, they're the ones that are going to be grinding their way through their shifts. They're going to be winning the battles in all three zones and really making a difference for this team.
Yeah, I saw that shift from Swartz. Very, 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 very gutsy, very, very gritty stuff out there from him. And, yeah, I think that this Atlantic Hockey recruits, Big East thing, kind of allows UConn to have a nice mix of those types of players, you know, to have, as Mike Cavanaugh said in the press conference, you know, after the game, to have your Patrick Kirtlands and Sean Pauleys, and to have them doing what they're doing and filling in those roles has been great. But, yeah, you know, you can't say enough about the freshmen on this team. I mean, Max Calter, you said he's a freshman as well. And then Letinov and Thompson have already notched hat tricks in this very young season. Yeah, maybe I was a little too far calling it monumental. UConn has beaten ranked teams before. UConn has beaten teams even ranked higher than this. And there's, in the hockey season, you know, there's kind of just enough randomness and just enough games where kind of anything can happen on a game-by-game basis. Always helps when you go 4 of 7 on the power play. But I guess, you know, I think for people who, again, aren't following the program so closely, what they'd probably be interested in knowing from someone like you, Tim, who has been following the team very closely for a few years now, is when do you think the team does reach that level where it is a top 10 team on a regular basis, where it's competing in that top three or four in Hockey East.
Well, whenever I think about where UConn's going, I think back to the coaching search a couple years ago after my first season covering the team, when it was down to Dave Berard, who was the interim coach in 2012-13. Then you had Mike Cavanaugh, obviously, the PC associate head coach at the time. And the third candidate was George Gwozdecki. He was 500-win coach at Denver, one of the elite coaches in college hockey. And he's now an assistant in the NHL, but he backed out of the process when he was down to that top three after his interview. And all he said afterward was, in 5 years, UConn's going to be raising banners. And I thought it was kind of early to say 5 years. I don't think that it's going to be 5 years from that point. That would obviously require in the next 2 years. But I think UConn is definitely on its way. Somewhere in that 10-year period, you know, you give Kavanaugh enough time, he's going to start putting those banners up. And I think it's going to be around when these freshmen become upperclassmen. I think sometime around their junior, senior year, they're going to be at a point where they can really compete with anybody. And I think they can compete with anybody now. They've shown that. They've won 6 games against ranked opponents since Kavanaugh came in. I don't see it happening this year. I don't see it happening even next year. But, you know, if they can keep recruiting well, they're going to keep recruiting well. Guys like Thompson and Letnov, if they stick around, which, you know, I'm sure we'll get at least 3 years out of Thompson, probably 3 or 4 out of Letnov too. I can't see those guys not winning something.
Yeah, definitely. You'd be hard pressed to think that they don't, given how significantly they're contributing this early in their career. Had another interesting piece of news come out this past week regarding the hockey program, and it kind of hits on a topic that's near and dear to us in the basketball realm as well, but Jeff Jacobs of the Hartford Courant posted an article saying that with UConn men's hockey's success in the Excel Center, the school is looking into, and they might have used even more stronger language than that, but the school is looking into making upgrades to the current venue, Freitas Ice Forum, which currently has a capacity of what, Tim? 500?
Like 2,000 at the most.
Of taking Freitas Ice Forum and upgrading it to meet these stipulations that Hockey East had required upon UConn of having a on-campus arena with a capacity above a certain number, I believe it was 3,000 or 4,000, by 2019. So, you know, what that means is that instead of the new on-campus arena that we thought we were going to be getting, they might instead be making upgrades to Freitas and continuing to play a lot of their games, particularly the marquee ones against the BCs and BUs of the world, at the Excel Center. Tim, would be interested to hear your thoughts on what this means for the program, how it will play out in terms of, you know, game day atmosphere and things like that.
Well, I think that this has pretty much been the writing on the wall for years now, ever since the announcement came that UConn was going to be moving to Hockey East, that they need an on-campus arena. I think there was always skepticism about it, just because, you know, the way UConn's built, it doesn't really lend itself to being a place where you can just build a new on-campus arena and have it be no issue, especially since, from what I understand, they have to keep Freitas open while they were building a new arena because of agreements that allow high school hockey teams in the area. E.O. Smith plays there to keep that open for them, for youth hockey. I believe it's an agreement with the state from what I've been told. So that made it difficult already. And obviously the success of UConn at the Excel Center has really helped out. I mean, they were bringing in between 5,000 and 8,000 fans every game, which is a big deal.
Yeah.
I mean, that's fantastic. My question is, if they're going to be building it to, 3,000 or 4,000 up on campus, what games would you put there? I mean, as UConn continues to get better, they're going to keep scheduling big opponents. You know, Quinnipiac's a really big opponent. Arizona State's going to be a big opponent. They've got some other teams that they could definitely bring in to play against. you know, I think of teams like Penn State and, you know, some of those Big Ten NCHC teams that could really drive attendance, ECAC even. The only teams I could see being worth playing up on campus are Sacred Heart, Army, Holy Cross, some of those Atlantic hockey teams from back in the old days, a couple of years ago. And as much as I'd like to see them play on campus, I mean, my thing has always been every game at Gamble, now every game up on campus for hockey, because, you know, it's a student's game too. And watching the game against BU the other night, the game started out and all you could hear were the 12 BU kids in one corner going nuts. And the UConn students are sitting on their hands saying absolutely nothing. Not until UConn scores a goal or has like a minute of zone time do they even start to get into the game. It was just irritating to watch them do absolutely nothing. Up on campus, the game could be more about the students, which is one of the great things about Hockey East. You go to Connie Forum, you go to Aganis Arena, Gutterson, it's all about the students. But UConn's also getting 6,000-7,000 fans a game playing in Hartford. You get all the people working in the middle of the city. You get people it's easier for them to drive to Hartford than it is to stores. So I get it. I get that with basketball too. So I guess if you're going to renovate just to make it 3,000-4,000 on campus, there's really not enough games that you can get on campus to justify that. I don't see the point at that point.
Yeah, and Brenner, I mean, you know, we see this in basketball, you know, just like we're saying, we see this in basketball too, you know, where the games are played in a slightly different venue. I mean, do the games have to be on campus?
Well, I wouldn't say they have to be on campus. I think it's a catch-22 that Tim talked about. It's easier for the average person, the average Connecticut citizen to get to Hartford and fill those games up, and when you're having success, it's easier to sell sponsors on the games in XL Center. But I think it's like Tim talked about, it's just the atmosphere that you're missing out on. You know, it's that die-hard, crazy, pumped-up atmosphere that you get when everybody's on campus. And, yeah, it's you'd obviously prefer it to have the main arena on campus with that type of life, but we've been dealing with this with basketball for, you know, years and years and years, and there's been plenty of games where we would have maybe wanted that extra bit of home field advantage that we get at Gamble as opposed to the games at XL Center. But when you also look at it, our basketball program has just come such a long, long, long way, and I think you have to say part of that can be attributed to games at the XL Center and getting it to be, you know, the biggest basketball in Connecticut and having it grow in popularity. And not everybody can make it out to stores. It's a long, long commute for anybody in Fairfield County. And I think just with basketball, having those games there, even though we might not like it as students because it's not as exciting or fun in the long run, it does help the program. It helps build the program. And if we can even just much quicker than building a brand new arena, if we're able to just keep filling up games, like you said, 6,000-7,000 at the XL Center, that'll be keeping the hockey program on the right track.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing is UConn's not really built for, the campus itself isn't built for a big sporting event. I mean, it's already a big enough struggle with basketball when they've got a game on campus that's sold out and you've got single lane traffic both ways for miles miles might be excessive, but once you get on the campus and it's just car after car not moving, it gets really irritating. And to now, you know, there's nights where there's hockey and basketball, both playing at home. And I mean, they can do that because of Gamble and XL, but imagine if you had to play home games for both hockey and basketball on the same night and both games were on campus. That would just be nightmarish. And I get wanting to keep all of that stuff in Hartford because, like you said, it's making UConn the center of attention in the state. It's making it the big-time hockey. And, you know, that was an NHL arena once. So, you know, for players to be able to come in and play in what was once an NHL arena where Gordie Howe was a legend and guys like Ron Francis and Al Samuelson, I mean, that's got to be a big deal for them.
Yeah, but I mean, the counter argument would be that, you know, if you're BU or if you're BC, you know, or even Northeastern, the TD Garden is right in your town, but they wouldn't want to play all their home games over there. They wouldn't want to play their huge home games over there. They'd want that on-campus environment. So, I mean, I'm kind of with you guys. I think of it as it's fine. We kind of
yeah, have... but I mean, if you look at it, Ramon, like if they were a school in Boston and they were 35 minutes away from actually Boston and people couldn't get to their school easily and they were just new to the American East, there might definitely be a possibility where it was the best move for them to play their games at the TD Garden, get some you know, excitement built up about the team, and then eventually, you know, you make a move. The only downside I think here is that they're talking about just like minor upgrades to the on-campus facility, which doesn't really lend itself to like just saying, hey, in the future we might switch to building a beautiful on-campus hockey facility, et cetera, et cetera. But
yeah,
I think that even in like a city like Boston, where they love hockey and it's a craze, if just given the situation and the logistics of it, if they were similar to UConn's, I could see a scenario where it would be beneficial to play in Boston Garden.
Yeah, and of course they do play their biggest games every year, BC, BU, Northeastern, and Harvard, in TD Garden, because no one will tell you that there's a bigger game for those teams than the Beanpot. I do think that the XL Center could really take a next step and have a big Connecticut tournament, UConn, Sacred Heart, Quinnipiac, and Yale. I think the only thing there is Yale doesn't want to do it, but I'm getting off topic. That's another thing that I can rant for hours about.
Well, we can maybe if Yale doesn't want to play... Which, by the way, is weird because didn't we play them in a thing last year?
Yeah, but that was out of state, and they're going to be at the Desert Classic too in Arizona.
Yeah,
it's just I don't know, for some reason they've never wanted to do a Beanpot style tournament with UConn, Quinnipiac, and Sacred Heart, which is dumb because there are three states with four Division I programs, the other being Minnesota, and they do the North Star Challenge Cup, which is fantastic. It's that same thing as the Beanpot. Connecticut just can't do it because
Yale thinks they're too awesome.
Well, we won a national championship a couple years ago.
Yeah. Well, that would definitely be a very, very cool tournament to have. We can cross our fingers about that and be very certain that it would be held at the XL Center if it did. Moving on. Actually, Tim, why don't you hit us with the soccer update?
All right. Tuesday night men's soccer won again. They are now 6-5-5 after winning 3 of their last 4, and they're unbeaten in those 4 after losing 5 out of 6 and going winless in 6. So nice change in these last 4 games of this 10-game stretch for UConn. They've got one more game against USF, a top 15 program this year, team that beat UConn on penalties at Moroni last year. This is going to be senior night. It's going to be the last time out for these guys. They need to win in order to realistically go for one of those home games in the conference quarterfinals on November 7th. It's going to be very tough for them to do that, but who knows. As for women's soccer keeps cruising, 16-2 overall now, 8-1 in the conference. The regular season, it's over, and they are the regular season champs in the American for the first time. First regular season conference title since 05, first time winning 16 games since 05. Just an unbelievable season for UConn. Sunday was only the third time they've given up a goal at home this year. They beat SMU 2-1, and it was just a fantastic goal from SMU, a little toe poke over the keeper, Allison Saucier, who was playing on senior night. And the great thing about UConn is they started all their seniors except for Megan Hunsberger, who was hurt, but all those seniors have been key contributors to this team. It's not just like they were rewarding someone for being a senior. They've made a big impact, them combined with the young players, especially the freshmen this year, who have made a huge difference. Could probably get 3 players on the all-freshman team. They've been fantastic. Now they go into the conference tournament. They play next Tuesday, November 3rd, against East Carolina. You're going to be able to watch it through the American website. They destroyed East Carolina in the first game. Great 3-0 victory at home. But it gets tough if they win. They play either Cincinnati or Tulsa. Cincinnati, they only beat 1-0 at home. Tulsa brought them to double overtime. UConn got the win on the road, so it's going to be a tough t- tough test to try and repeat as American champions. But field hockey, meanwhile, continues to roll, 17-0, 4-0 in the conference. They have already clinched the Big East regular season title, and, you know, they'll probably win the Big East tournament. They'll probably win the national championship. They are now even closer to that. They've outscored their opponents 104-6 all season. They gave up a goal against Princeton after going 8 games without giving up a goal, so a little disappointing, but they close out the season this weekend against Georgetown, so they'll probably be 18-0 by the time the postseason starts. Probably going to pull one of those UConn women's basketballs and go undefeated.
Yep, we've been tooting that horn for a while now here on the podcast. Do your best to support the field hockey team as they strive for their third straight national championship, which is, you know, pretty amazing stuff. And great to see the women's soccer team also having an opportunity to make a big splash nationally, I think, you know, this year with how good they're looking and, you know, where they might end up in the NCAA tournament, and exciting stuff to see all around. What was not as exciting, unfortunately, was the UConn football game this past Saturday. The Huskies were very handily taken care of by Cincinnati. The final score, very ugly, 37-13. I mean, for the first time, you know, in my opinion, the offense looked completely lost out there. And, I mean, it just, so many things were going wrong, really, in all three phases. The Huskies were completely outplayed there. And, you know, it's unfortunate because Diaco said in his Tuesday press conference, we feel like we haven't been beaten by a team. But that's exactly what happened on Saturday. And now, you know, UConn's 3-5, got a tough game with ECU on Friday. You know, we'll definitely get into that a little bit. But Brenner, you know, takeaways from the Cincinnati game?
Yeah, like you said, it was very, very tough. The worst game this year, just a bit demoralizing in terms of, I think is the first time we felt overmatched. Just like there was no chance. Pretty much as soon as that second half started, you felt like there was no chance that UConn was going to come back and even make this a game. I was encouraged in the beginning with the first drive where we were running the quarterback draw and Sheriffs was cutting them up. We're up 7-0 and things are looking like, you know what, this is the team that gave up 30 points to an FCS school, and this is a defense that we can move the ball on. And then they make the adjustment, bring in the linebacker to spy on Sheriffs and shut down the quarterback run. And I thought that would be the perfect time to force an adjustment, accept the adjustment, and then go ahead and we'll make our own adjustment. And this time I wanted to throw the ball to the tight ends. Like Tim and I spoke last week, Tommy Myers and Alec Bloom just never see the ball, ever. And that continued again this week. They kept the linebacker in to spy. So the middle of the field there was tons of room in the second level for the tight ends to work. And we literally never even drew up a play. It felt like we went the entire game without even calling a play that where they would be the primary receiver. I was discouraged by the predictability of the UConn offense. Once again, just that swing pass constantly to Arkell, like it's fooling someone. So many times I felt like just predictable second and 10, second and 9 runs up the middle from the I-form set, like here we come, we're going to run it. And then the announcers mentioned something that I don't typically agree with, but I think it really reared its head in this game, which is a lot of times like early success, it's said for a quarterback running the ball can be a detriment because they use it as a crutch for the rest of the game. I don't believe in that typically. I like to think that when you have success early and you force the defense, you're basically making the first chess move and you're going to force them to change their setup and then you're going to adjust accordingly. However, in this game, since we did not change our setup and they adjusted accordingly, it did seem like many times when it was 3rd and 3, 3rd and 4, we need a, a play and Sheriff's just pulling it down, not even looking. If the first read is not instantly right there, he's pulling it down, and now we're getting 1-2 yards. He's getting stopped at the line, and there were 5 or 6 nothing running plays that we got where it really did look like he was just pulling it down too early and trying to just run the ball safely, get the safe play. I mean, when you have a Division I quarterback who completes 12 of 27 for 87 yards in a game, I think that's why you saw Tim Boyle at the end, because you got to throw the ball better. And we just haven't seen accurate enough, consistent enough throws from Sheriffs this year, in my opinion. The last couple of games he had a better offensive performance because of his ability to run, and I'm sure that's why he got the job in the first place. We stated that early in the season. He's a dual threat, but boy, his throws have been really bad. And the one throw I will mention, the one throw that I thought was a good throw or borderline good, he still threw it behind Noel Thomas, and he had to come back to it. But that one play by Noel Thomas where he dropped a long pass down the sideline pretty much just took all the air out of the game. And that was really like the one throw that I said to myself, oh, that was actually a good throw by Sheriffs today. So many overthrows, underthrows, just in the 2 yards in front of receivers where they have absolutely no chance. Just sucks the morale out of your team. I didn't like how Fergie Mayala had absolutely no input offensively, just no targets. I know we tried to get it to Noel Thomas a few times. I did like how we got it to Tyreek Beals a couple times, but really, I wanted to see – I think we just need to see a better throwing offensive performance, because I don't think you can really grow offensively with the gimmick quarterback run in between type of offense that we actually have had success with. I think we need to grow into a legitimate passing offense.
Yeah, and obviously I didn't get to watch the game because I was up in Boston covering the UConn-BU hockey game. But everything I saw on Twitter, I mean, I think it was 3 minutes after the game started, and it seemed like everyone was celebrating sarcastically when UConn scored their opening touchdown. Everyone just had a really bad feeling about how the game was going to go, and after that, all I saw was stuff about time management, awful decisions with the ball offensively, and I was surprised when I saw UConn only had 2 turnovers, had the ball about 50-50 with Cincinnati in terms of time of possession. You're not gonna win a football game when you give up 612 yards of total offense, especially when that's a third of what you were able to produce a week after going for 528 yards and producing about the same offensive output as you did with 266. And something that's jumping out at me as I look, I mean, I feel like this is a game where, you know, they say numbers never lie, and you know, Diaco said all this stuff about we haven't been beaten by an opponent yet. Don't look at the box score. It doesn't tell the story. I'm pretty sure that's, you know, when a team gets 327 passing yards and you only get 266 yards of total offense, when they just dominate you like that, you're not going to win the football game. And UConn, I'm surprised, was very disciplined with its penalties. Only 3 penalties for 25 yards in the whole game. That's shockingly low for the way UConn has been flagged this year. Cincinnati had 105 yards of penalties and still manages 612 yards of total offense and still manages to just own UConn from start to finish. That's pathetic to me. I mean, I didn't even have to watch this game to know that this was an embarrassing performance for the Huskies, and I mean, that pretty much ends all that talk we had about, oh, UConn might be able to go to a bowl game. No, not if they're playing like that, and especially with their schedule at the end of the year, because it could get uglier.
Yeah, I mean, now it's not looking too hot for a bowl game, sitting at 3-5 with ECU, Tulane, who might be beatable, and then Houston and Temple, 2 ranked teams, top 25 teams left on the schedule for sure. And I think, you know, it's not just that we lost. It's not just that we lost by that many points. You know, I mean, the BYU game ended 30-13, I believe. But it's just the way it went down. The offense, like I said, looked completely hopeless. The play calling was extremely predictable, and not just predictable, but showed a very small variety. You know, there were really only like four different plays. You know, that
that's been the whole season.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, then we need to then what's the point of hanging out with Sherris for this long if we feel like he can run four or five plays and he's not going to be the future of the program?
You know, right. Like, so that's
what is the point?
Well, that's where I'm getting is. I mean, Sherris, he's definitely a high character guy. He's you know, one of those the coaches say film room junkie and all that stuff. He's got great heart and he is able to make plays with his legs, but his throws on Saturday were now, you know, we're not talking about like, oh, you know, dude had a couple errant throws. Now we're talking about missing a lot of throws.
We're talking about like not Division I type stuff is what we saw.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, you know, and then the other thing is we have a play caller, Frank Verducci, our offensive coordinator. This is his first year calling plays. You know, for all of his experience, 30 plus years in football, et cetera, this is his first year as the play caller for an offense. So there's going to be a learning curve, I guess. You know, we're talking about a 60 plus year old man on a learning curve right now. Never really liked those odds. But, you know, if Brian Sheriffs can't make the throws, you know, and doesn't seem to have command of the offense, you know, like you said, 12 of 27, being at that point where you stop looking to pass and you're looking to run, you know, are we reaching that point in his quote-unquote development? That's not it's starting to be an area of concern, because that's not a great Cincinnati defense that we were playing against. That's a Cincinnati defense giving up 30 plus points per game. You know, that the only team to score fewer points than UConn against was Alabama A&M, who put up a 10 spot. But, you know, even Miami of Ohio put up 30-something points on this team. So this didn't happen against some juggernaut defense.
That's what I wanted to bring up again, was that, like you said, Miami of Ohio. We're talking about just a lower tier program, 30 points. And we could not have struggled more to get 13. And the worst part about it is we got 7 on the first drive, like they were cutting a knife through butter. And after that, 2 field goals, and boy, it was an absolute struggle to get those 2 field goals. There were, as you said, with the play calling, there were drives where it felt like the other team had a sign being held up from our sideline that was like, we're doing this next. And they were like, okay, we've seen this one before. We're ready for that. Let's take care of it. And yet, the worst part is that, like, you're still in the game. You're hanging around, and the defense is just out there for play after play after play after play until eventually they're just running the ball down our throat, and we're looking like a Division II team. He's running for 140 yards. Hosey Williams ran for 140 yards on 13 carries.
Yeah, that was one 80-yard carry. But yeah, you're right. The defense.
But even if you take out the 80-yard carry, 12 for 65 is still over 5 yards a carry that he's rushing against us. And it just running it down our throat. It was just – it gets demoralizing, I think, for the rest of the team. When as soon as you know and you lose that hope that your offense can go out there and get something done and change the game and bring you back in it, as soon as you lose that hope, I think you can see it in the body language on the defense. They just – they lose that fire that they believe that could, you know, keep the game close. Maybe they have a chance, and it just it was embarrassing.
Go ahead.
Oh, you got to question Diaco's decision-making sometimes when, you know, on top of everything Brenner just said, they were down 17 early in the fourth quarter, or I should say closer to halfway through the fourth quarter. And, you know, this is a guy who's done fake field goals and all this ridiculous stuff this year against teams that, you know, their games didn't necessarily count for much more against. And he's going to just put out Bobby Poyle with, you know, a 17-point deficit in the fourth quarter for a field goal. On fourth down, I get it that, you know, it was probably the best chance to get points, but at that point in the game, with everything you've already done this year, just go for it. Just go for it. Make it, you know, give yourself a chance to get within 10 or 9, get the ball back, and, you know, make something else happen. It's just, I don't know. He doesn't make sense to me.
I have to agree with the play calling. Like, he takes all these risks at other times during the year, and then we just seem to have, like, the most vanilla, bland, and just passive, conservative play calls. Just like, we don't want to go too crazy here. Let's not take some type of risk here and, you know, throw a 15-yard out route. Like, is that not even in our playbook? Just, like, regular passing route trees that you would see seem to just not be in our playbook.
I can't wait for the college football video game to come back, and when you play with UConn, you get the option for all the different style offense you have. So there's, like, I formation, spread offense, whatever, and then you get to UConn's swing pass offense.
Swings and screens.
Oh my God.
Cincinnati was all over.
Everyone's all over it. Everyone.
Because if you never go downfield, the screen pass is the only thing they're looking for. I mean, it's just like...
The secret tag. The secret
tag. They run that play 3 to 5 times a drive. I mean...
Arkell Newsom starts running to the right of the quarterback. Everyone on the defense is like, there's a 90% chance you're throwing a 2-yard pass behind the line of scrimmage to him right now.
I mean, so Brenner, you mentioned the 15-yard out. I'm sure they'd love to run a 15-yard out, but their offensive line, they can't handle a 5-step drop. You know, I think that's a big part of it. Is, you know, half of those times Sharefs goes back there to throw, he's got a dude in his face immediately. You know, and that's why he's been so prone to running as well.
I agree with that. I agree. They definitely the line is not good, and it showed it this week. But also, when you become predictable, that's when it's the easiest for the defensive line and the hardest for the offensive line. So if maybe a couple 3-step drops, real quick passes, let's get it to Tyreek Beals, and then maybe someday we get the defense on their heels and they're thinking to themselves, could they run it or pass it? That's an option, as opposed to here we know what's coming and we're going to stop it every single time. And then when we get you in third and long, no chance of throwing a 10-yard pass because, like you said, Richard Levi can't hold up. Neither guard could hold up. The interior of the line was just getting blown off the ball. And that happens when they can pin their ears back and know what's coming.
And they, you know, those first couple games, the offensive line looked solid, which was a big deal with Ryan Crozier out for the season, Brandon Vetteri playing under center, you know, some inexperience there. I still think Andreas Knapp is kind of an inexperienced lineman. He's a captain, for crying out loud. But, you know, you run a certain number of plays every game, and like you said, predictability. You know what's coming, and that makes it so much easier for them to break through into the backfield and wrap Sheriffs up or, like, sniff out a run or a swing pass before it happens. So they've got to have more play options. I mean, at this point, Tim Boyle's in his third year here, and I think both seasons so far we've come to a crossroads where we say, when is it going to be Tim Boyle's turn? And, you know, this is a guy who probably knows the playbook inside and out, can probably run just about everything. I'd love to see him get his shot. I mean, I feel like at this point, screw it. Like, why not? He did well his freshman year when he came in, and I thought he did okay last year too. Just give him the ball.
Totally agree. I think it's time to just see what he can do. Amon, I know you were at practice with me, and we were just watching just the basic quarterback drills, you know, just throwing the ball at X position, wherever the target was. And Boyle was impressive, and Sheriffs was not, to be completely honest. We saw that before the first game of the year. We said, boy, his weakness looks to be literally throwing the football. And that can be concerning as a quarterback. So I think it is time to, at this point, once we lost to South Florida, our bowl chances just, you know, they went out the window. That's the bottom line. If we had won that game, then maybe you're thinking, okay, we steal East Carolina and maybe we get into a bowl game. But at this point, we're not going to go to a bowl game. I don't think we can continue running Sheriffs out there. What's the point? The longevity, there's no point in that. So let's try to start working for the future and bring in some guys who can actually throw the ball better. We do know that Tim Boyle is better at throwing the football. Let's see if we can work an offense around him and a more of an actual football offense. No gimmicks, nothing set up to do quarterback runs. Let's just try to have an actual football offense where we're throwing the football effectively.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I'm all for Tim Boyle, you know, and I think those observations that you have of him have rung true for the past couple of years. I think that's that's the reason he was given the starting nod his true freshman year. It's you know, the reason he got an extended look last year. And he looked, you know, solid out there. He's got the arm. We've always known that he's got the arm. Receivers seem a little bit surprised when the ball comes in there with a little bit of zip. They might need to adjust to that. You know, the other thing about Boyle was that last year he had some lingering injuries, which, you know, Diaco said at the beginning of this season have been fixed. So if Boyle can be a slightly more mobile quarterback, and I don't mean by that, I don't mean read option, designed runs, anything like that. I mean, you know, if he can roll out, if he can move the pocket, if he can be nimble in the pocket, you know, if he can hang in and make those throws, you know, then we have a contender. And I mean, I'm inclined to think he might be there. I think it is too early to say, you know, unilaterally, let's just get Sharefs out of here. It's his time has passed.
So yeah, we don't need to give up on Sharefs, you know, just yet. It's obviously a little too early to do that after really what is his first bad game. I mean, there have been we've started to see some throws come out poorly across the season now for a couple of games, but you know, just the previous week against South Florida, he put up a really good performance, at least statistically, against a good defense. You know, he seems to have those intangible qualities that Diaco and many other football coaches around the world really like, film room junkie, very coachable, et cetera. And, you know, maybe they can find a way to win around him. But, you know, it definitely is time to start having the beginning of that conversation, because it looked so bad. It looked so bad on Saturday what happened. Now, part of that, you know, you can't put that fully on him. The offense, you know, as we discussed, you know, I don't even think it would be fair to call it one dimensional. It was zero dimensional or negative two dimensional. You know, just in the complete lack of variety we saw in the play calling. So I think, you know, part of that is Frank Verducci, new offensive coordinator, hasn't been a play caller yet, needing to find more ways to put him in a position to succeed. And then the other thing, you know, we'll talk about it all year, is the offensive line. I mean, how much time does he really have to throw back there with the offensive line in front of him? Can he do a five-step drop? You know, definitely not when the defense is expecting a pass. So, you know, he's been in a tough spot, and then UConn's in a tough spot this Friday when we think about redeeming themselves. So we can just kind of move on now and talk about the East Carolina game tonight. I mean, with one fewer day of rest and East Carolina actually having a full week of rest because they played on Thursday the previous week, you know, they're going to have to show an improved performance against what is a better defense. I think ECU is actually pretty good. Have you had a chance to take a look at the Pirates, Benner?
Yeah, I actually have to agree with you. They're pretty good, and when you factor in the extra time to prepare and the short week for UConn, those are all factors that typically go against a team winning the game. But at least the Huskies are at home. We got that going for us. We got the alternate unis. All right, yeah. So you know, maybe there's a little magic in the gray. You know, I guess that's what we're just grasping at straws here. That's kind of unfortunate that another season came down to looking at the alternate uniforms when it had. It felt like there was promise, but just a few plays here and there, and at least we can look back and say that we went for it. Unfortunately, I think East Carolina, this game's gonna. If I had to guess, I would say mirror the BYU game. You know, a game where it's like it's close, we're hanging around. And then late in the game, a couple big plays go against us, costly turnover, and things start to snowball. And it ends up being a pretty comfortable win for East Carolina.
So it's a 7-point spread right now in Las Vegas for the people who are interested in that kind of thing.
And that would be tough to take again. 13 was ambitious last week.
But it happened.
I would say 7 is ambitious again.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I look at this East Carolina team. I think they're pretty good. I mean, they're 4-4, which isn't an awesome record, but I mean, their losses are all very, very excusable.
At Florida, 31-24. I mean, they were right in that game. They lost at BYU, 45-38. They were right in that game. They lost at Temple, 24-14. They were right in that game. So, yeah. The only one, though, Navy got on top of them pretty good.
Yeah, Navy's a good team, but they're also a unique team. In you know, as we very well know, and Navy, I remember looking at that game. Navy scored on their first four possessions. That's basically game over. You know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That offense starts to snowball too.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a good East Carolina team, offensively and defensively. I think for them, for their defense to play the way that they did against Temple. You know, last week, I think Temple's a really good offensive team holding them to, I mean, they had them at 10 points going into the fourth quarter
and the block punt hurt.
Yeah, exactly. It was a block punt at the end. A couple of other plays that really put them in rough situations. And then Temple was able to score, and Temple had to really go outside of their element and actually lean on the passing game to make it happen. Which is, you know, credit to Temple for being able to do that, being able to adjust, especially because we've seen kind of the hallmark of this UConn team is an inability to adjust in games.
Certainly. And you kind of have to look out for Bryce Williams, positive tight end for East Carolina. I think one thing that you're probably going to see a lot of regardless is Arkiel Newsom. I think we can pencil that in. That this game looks to be, if you're UConn, this probably feels like the only home game that you're going to be able to win this year. And Houston's going to be rough. So in terms of home games for the rest of this year to win, you only got two choices. Houston's ranked, and this game probably go all out to try to win it. We know that. And I think that regardless, as we were talking about, oh, maybe it's time to give Boyle a shot, etc. Diaco probably feels that in his game, his best chance to win is Sheriff's, basically to Arkiel Newsom. Probably going to see a lot of swing passes. Probably going to see the QB draw. Probably going to see the same stuff that we saw in the UCF game, or USF game rather, where we were moving the football. But I would predict the outcome's probably going to.
Yeah, where they're not able to clinch it. I mean, yeah, you're right. They're going to have to pull out all the stops because the season really is at – it's reaching that, like, inflection point, you know, where if it's like, all right, well, we're 3-6 now. We just got blown out twice in a row. I'm done with the season, you know, versus people still kind of following, tracking it, hoping that –
You know, 4-5 going to Tulane. Now you're thinking, wow, we'll be who thought we could be 5-5? You know what I mean? No one. So it's just this is really like you said, the inflection point, really the make or break game for the Huskies. Because if you lose this game and maybe then you're just Tulane's your only winnable game left. Now you're 4-8, 3-9. It's just a completely different feel than going 5-7. And you know, you lost to two ranked teams to finish it out. Maybe you play well. It's just a completely different feel to the season. You actually feel like you had a positive step forward. Whereas you lose this game and then you're a crazy loss at Tulane away from, you know, a 5-game losing streak to end the season again.
Right.
So
right.
Very important game for the Huskies to come out. And that's why I think you're just going to see Newsom, 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 Newsom.
Well, I hope we see something different, you know, because like you said, it's time to pull out all the stops. Anything, if you've been saving anything, Bob and Frank,
if there's any type of flea flicker in there or just a double reverse, something crazy.
Yeah, you know, I mean, East Carolina, the other thing about them is that offense is really, really tough to stop. They've got two different quarterbacks, James Summers, who's more of a dual threat guy. He's got over 400 rushing yards on the year. And then they've got another guy, a lefty. Not that that matters. We're talking quarterbacks, but lefty Blake Kemp, who has a cannon for an arm. He's a playmaker as well. He can do it with his legs. He doesn't very often. So UConn's going to just. I mean, the defense is really going to be challenged. ECU has, you know, you mentioned the tight end, but they have four other really good receivers. a good running back in Chris Harrison. It's going to be a big challenge for UConn, especially the secondary, who, you know, for me, this whole season, Brenner, has been kind of disappointing when they are, you know, when they have been up to the challenge of somebody passing on them a lot or put up to that challenge.
No, I completely agree. The secondary, Javon Williams, has been targeted over and over again in these games. He looks lackadaisical at times. These guys, they've made some plays on the ball throughout the season, some interceptions, some takeaways that kind of, I feel, almost masked the poor play that we've seen. Even from Andrew Adams, you know, guys who are experienced, guys who are supposed to be our best players, you see a lot of missed tackles in the secondary. You see a lot of balls where you should have a play on the ball. If you would turn around and play the ball, it's up there. It's up for grabs. And we look lost a lot of times, just completely beat. Like I said, Javon Williams has had, in my opinion, just a really tough season, just getting targeted every single game relentlessly. And I think that, once again, you've mentioned the inability to adjust. We never really seem to change anything up, give these guys maybe some help, or maybe allow them to press up at the line or do something else, try to get a jam on the receivers. But it's a lot of this off coverage, and he doesn't seem to be the quickest out of his break. So let these quick guys get going on him, and then they make their move. And, you know, an accurate quarterback's going to eat us up. And I think that's exactly what we saw in the Cincinnati game. And, you know, Gunnar Keogh, he wanted to come out, prove that it was his team, that it was his show. And, I mean, he sliced the Huskies up. So I really have to agree that the secondary has been a disappointment, certainly a disappointment. And it has to be said that Huskies haven't been getting the pressure that they used to get, I think, in the past couple of years, which obviously takes a ton of pressure off of the secondary when you're making the quarterback hurry. But really, we have not had a pass rush. You know, the pass rush has not been there. Foley Fadakasi is the only guy that I see when I'm watching these games that is getting movement consistently at the line of scrimmage. I would actually like to see maybe move him around, you know, a little bit more. They did a couple times last game, and they had success. I would like to see bring him inside, bring him out on the end, let him rush from the end, because there was a large stretch in that Cincinnati game where they're just running the ball the opposite direction of him, you know, letting him line up, double team him, or just run a toss the complete other side of the field and make him run 20 yards to chase the guy down for a 5-yard gain, and just kind of negating our best player. So,
yeah. So, I mean, we're looking for improvement in both phases, all three, really, you know, when you factor in special teams, always an area UConn's looking to improve. Tough task. And I mean, it's been a tough schedule. You look back on the season, you look ahead, and it has been, you know, there have been a lot of very, very good teams on the schedule. Does that give the Huskies any leeway, you think, with the fan base, that, you know, it might be a 4-8, it might be a 5-7 season, but I mean, it's probably going to be a 4-8 season, but there were like seven very, very good teams on the schedule.
No, I have to agree. The schedule is a lot better than it looks, but I'm not sure it gives the Huskies any leeway with the fans, just because they, on the top level, they look at a loss to USF, Cincinnati, you know, whether it be East Carolina this weekend, they're saying, we're getting beat by those teams. And on paper, they don't, you know, those are the teams that jump out at you. So I think that the result, when you're looking at 4-8, you can't get the leeway, I don't think. Even though we know that the schedule was better than we thought it would be going into the season, we didn't think that there would be really this much ranked American football. I mean, really, the conference has been – it's been surprising, and it's really a positive, but it didn't positively affect UConn's schedule. We'll say that. It helped overall, and I think it's a good thing still, because if UConn gets to that level, then at least this is a conference that can be that jumping off point for them and get into some top level football, whether it be like, you know, I know it's crazy talk, but if you had a good enough team, you could make the college football playoff from the American based on how it's played this year. So I think that overall is a more of a positive for UConn, because you know, we're not looking to be a 5-5, 6-6 bowl team. Yeah, we were looking for that this year, but that's not where we want to be, you know. So we would rather have a harder schedule and need to get there and get better and get to the top level than just be playing in a mediocre league where we could be mediocre and play mediocre teams every week.
Yeah, I mean, it's the conference, but also the non-conference this year was tough with BYU and Missouri on the schedule. I mean, if you talk about next year, we're going to have a better team and, you know, arguably easier non-conference schedule with instead of Villanova, you got Maine. And then instead of BYU, Missouri, you've got Syracuse, Boston College, and Virginia. So, you know, the scheduling is in place for things to look better next year. But then, yeah, I mean, in the conference, I mean, we knew Houston would be good. We knew Temple would be good. Navy, East Carolina, you know, but we didn't really know that they'd be this good.
Exactly.
So we'll actually close the podcast with this. You know, speaking of the American marquee opportunity for the conference this weekend, number 9, Notre Dame, visiting Temple this weekend. Brenner, you think Temple can pull it off?
Ooh, I can pull it off. Yeah, they can. I mean, it's possible. They have the players to do it. They have the talent to do it. But do I think that they will? No, I don't. I think that Notre Dame feels that they are a title contender. I think that Notre Dame feels that even with their one loss, if they win out, they'll be in the playoff. And I think Temple's going to get their absolute best shot. So if they were able to stand up and beat them and beat Notre Dame this weekend, I would be overly impressed. And it would say a lot for the type of football that this conference is playing right now.
Yeah, I mean, it would definitely say a lot, especially because, you know, for as good as Temple is, they might not even be the best team in the conference. So if they can get that win, it would definitely show a lot. But, yeah, I mean, it'll definitely be tough. Notre Dame has looked really good this year.
I get scared when I see that UMass 25-23 win for Temple. You know, yeah, I don't, you know, Notre Dame plays UMass. What do you think the score is going to be? But
I know, but anything can happen on a game, you know, Saturday.
Exactly, and exactly. That's why they play the games. It's not on paper. So I just think, it'll be a very, very tall order for Temple this weekend.
Well, it should be interesting to watch at least. That'll be at 8 p.m. on Saturday. UConn's game against East Carolina will be Friday night on ESPNU at 7 p.m. You can all watch and be sure to follow along with us at the UConn blog. For Brenner and Tim, this is Amon. That's going to do it for us this week. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.